Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. As promised, our guest this hour is Michael Lofton, who you can find at Reason and Theology. You can see the YouTubes and the audio stuff that he makes over there, and all just lots of wonderful stuff. But as many of you probably know about Michael Lofton, among the things that he is most noted for is this kind of dialogue, debate, ongoing conversation that he has about orthodoxy from the Catholic perspective and with Orthodox and Catholic people about these things. Michael Lofton has a new book called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. Michael Lofton, welcome.
Hey, Cy. Thanks for having me back on.
Congratulations on the beautiful new book, Answering Orthodoxy.
Thank you. Yeah, just got my copy today as well.
You know what? I liked the way you did the book because I realized the way you kind of do it is you, in quotes, you'll give an objection to the Catholic faith from the Orthodox position, and then you'll answer that objection. Mm-hmm. And as a Catholic, I honestly didn't know that they had these many of these objections. There's way more than I realized that are objections to the Catholic faith.
Oh, yeah. And believe it or not, there's even more than the ones that I address there. But in the book, I have kind of like your top 30 objections, which kind of span doctrinal objections, historical objections, and liturgical objections. So I give you the most common ones that you're going to encounter.
If you'd like to get in on the conversation about orthodoxy from the Catholic perspective, you're welcome, whether you're Orthodox, whether you're a Catholic person, whether you are neither, and you just like to get in your question for Michael, 888-318-7884. I feel like most of our audience knows what a Catholic is, but I feel like before we get into a conversation about answering orthodoxy, we need you to tell us, what is orthodoxy?
Yeah, Eastern Orthodoxy is going to be a community of 16 different autocephalous churches. That's a fancy term that just kind of means not necessarily independent, but self-governed, if you will, though they most of them are in communion with each other. And they have a past with us. So we, as well as the Eastern Orthodox, used to be part of the United Church, but we have gone our separate ways, unfortunately. You know, you can't really pinpoint a particular date. People say 1054, but that's not really accurate. It happened over a long period of time. But unfortunately, there was a breaking of communion between our respective churches. And what we're trying to do right now is work towards reunion or recommunion.
If you'd like to be in on that conversation, again, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. We live in a time of ecumenism. We've been hearing about ecumenism for decades now, and that has produced fruits, and they are important fruits, certainly. Does a book like this get in the way of ecumenism?
Some people might feel that way, but I don't believe it does, nor did I have any intention of it getting in the way. What I'm doing here is I'm pointing Catholics who are discerning Eastern Orthodoxy, so they're discerning leaving Catholic communion to Eastern Orthodoxy, I'm pointing them to the responses that we have from Eastern Orthodox objections. So I'm kind of showing them the reasons why they would consider leaving aren't necessarily valid. So they might want to reconsider their decision. But it's also beneficial for Eastern Orthodox to see how their objections to Catholicism aren't warranted. In fact, many of the things they're objecting to, I point out in the book, are actually found in their own Eastern tradition. So if they want to fully embrace their own tradition, that would actually help facilitate reunion because we would be on the same page. But it would not necessarily go against ecumenism, which is, again, working towards reunion. In fact, I think this should help facilitate it because I'm pointing out that Eastern Orthodox don't have to abandon their tradition for reunion with Rome. They simply need to fully embrace their own Eastern tradition, and they will then find things like the papacy, the Immaculate Conception, purgatory, things that they generally object to, they'll find it in their own communion. So I think that actually helps ecumenism.
Yeah, it sounds like it. 888-318-7884. But as you were speaking, it occurred to me, like, so if people are leaving the Catholic faith for orthodoxy, it might be that they would leave the practice in the Catholic Church because of an objection. But are people, or is it just, I'm sick. Like, what are you hearing from people? Are people saying, I'm sick of the Catholic Church, all the scandals or whatever they might say, and mm-hmm. and they have all the sacraments in Orthodoxy, so I'm going. Like, which do you think it is that's moving people from Catholicism to Orthodoxy?
Yeah, some people start with a position where they're dissatisfied with the Catholic Church, and so they then start to look for other options. They see the Eastern Orthodox have valid sacraments in our historical local churches, and so they then start to discern Eastern Orthodoxy. You certainly have many people who fit that bill. Others are either discerning Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy just from a historical perspective, and they're trying to determine which communion to join. And in fact, I think this book would even be beneficial for them. So Protestants who are discerning Catholicism and Orthodoxy. And then you'll have some who are just simply looking at things from a doctrinal perspective. They're not dissatisfied with their current communion, even if it's Catholicism. They're not dissatisfied, but they want to consider what is the position of the first millennium. You know, what did the church believe in the first 3 or 4 centuries? And they'll explore those questions. And sometimes they have a leaning towards Eastern Orthodoxy. And I try to show them that, in fact, the Catholic claims, including the papacy, are found there in the first millennium. So if you actually want to embrace the first millennium in the early church, you have to embrace its teachings, for instance, on the papacy.
Well, you know, we have a book from Joe Heschmeyer called The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Would an Orthodox person embrace a phrase, maybe something like the early church was the Orthodox Church?
Well, yes, most Eastern Orthodox are going to say that they are the church mm-hmm. of the first millennium or even the first century. They are the Catholic Church. In fact, they'll use that term.
Okay.
When we refer to Eastern Orthodox as Eastern Orthodox, that's actually not even their official name. Their official name is Orthodox Catholic Church. And so they do claim to be the Catholic Church. And so that's kind of where the dispute is. Okay, well, what did the Catholic Church teach prior to our division? What did they teach on things like the filioque or purgatory or the papacy? They're, of course, going to maintain their views are what the Catholic Church taught then. And that's where we as Catholics have to answer some of their objections and show them otherwise. And that's certainly what I intend to do in the book.
Michael Lofton is our guest. His new book, it's brand new, as a matter of fact, and it's got just a beautiful cover. It's called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. And I have to say, it is not a difficult theological tome that you have to plow through. It's very accessible in the sense that in bold is given the objection from the Orthodox perspective, and then in plain type is given Michael's response. Maybe it's 2 pages, maybe it's 4, 5, 6 pages. So you can, you know, you could do the 30 of them in very short order, or just find the ones that are relevant to the discussions that are going on in your family or where you are, and check those out. So again, I will recommend the book "Answering Orthodoxy: A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East." If you'd like to just get in on the conversation here, 888-318-7884. I do want to ask you about the word "attacks from the East," because mm-hmm. I wonder if the development of modern technology, where we can actually converse with one another over great distances, but also the ecumenical movement itself, which has occasioned more conversation between us, has given rise to Catholics who attack Orthodox people, Orthodox people who mm-hmm. attack Catholics, mm-hmm. maybe more than was happening even, say, 100 years ago.
Yes, I think that's true, and it's unfortunate. And that's not to say that we should ignore any of our differences and we shouldn't discuss them and even debate them. But it is to say that, yeah, some of the conversations that we have between Catholics and Orthodox are not the most productive. And so I tend to avoid that, in fact, in the book. I'm not trying to dunk on Orthodox and put them down. In fact, I'm trying to show them, look, there really is no reason for this schism to be perpetuated. There really is no reason. We should be in communion with one another because we share a same heritage, the heritage of the first millennium. And in that heritage is everything that we believe essentially. And it's in line with what they believe essentially as well. I do agree, however, though, that some of those discussions online are not the most productive. And you can certainly see that from, as you pointed out, some Catholics who attack Orthodox and some Orthodox, unfortunately, who attack Catholics. And I'm addressing a lot of those arguments that you'll probably find in some of those circles.
But the Orthodox Church has produced saints, real saints, not like imitation saints, but real saints. And if it can produce saints, there's a tradition there that's worth honoring, not just attacking.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the objections that I address here is the fact that, for example, I belong to an Eastern Catholic Church, and we venerate some Orthodox saints after the period of what's commonly called the schism.
Yeah.
After 1054. Again, I dispute whether or not that's really when the schism happened, but we actually have some post-schism saints in Orthodoxy that we venerate in some of the Eastern Catholic churches. And I address that because some Orthodox bring that up as an objection against our own ecclesiology. And so I address that there. But by pointing that out, I'm noting that, yes, there is sanctity to be found in Eastern Orthodoxy because they have the seven sacraments. That's not to say that there's no point in reunion. That's to say that Catholics don't have the fullness of the faith. But it is to say that sanctity can be achieved in the Eastern Orthodox churches, most certainly.
888-318-7884, Orthodox, Catholic, or other, you're welcome to call and talk with Michael about Answering Orthodoxy, his new book. Michael, before I go to the callers, just one more thing I want to ask you about, and that is the Orthodox view of the Bishop of Rome. Do they, is there a sense in Orthodoxy that they do need to be in communion with the bishop at some point and in some way, or is that no longer the case?
Well, it's a mixed bag. There is no one view on the papacy among the Eastern Orthodox, but what you will find is a pretty wide range where some will just say, look, there's absolutely no point in the papacy. The Pope is a heretic. He's a schismatic. We don't need him. You have that ranging all the way to some who say, we need communion with the Bishop of Rome because we need unity in the Eastern Orthodox churches. And the only way we can facilitate that is if we have the Pope as the universal head. And so you can find a pretty wide range there. So some Orthodox will certainly say, we need the Pope. Others will say, no, we don't need him. He's a heretic.
All right. Time to go to callers. We have to take our quick first break, and then we will come right back and let callers talk with Michael Lofton about his new book, Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Are you prepared to vote?
Citizens have a co-responsibility for society. The moral theology tradition teaches that one may not vote for an enemy of religion or of freedom, except to exclude a worse enemy of religion and of freedom.
Learn more so you're prepared when you vote this November. Visit EWTN.com/vote for everything Catholic voters need to know before picking up a ballot.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Michael Lofton is our guest. You know Michael from Reason and Theology, and also from, I would hope, from his appearances quite regularly here. Now he's got a brand new book out. It's called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. If you'd like to talk about the relationship between Catholics and Orthodox people, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Byron is in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Byron, go ahead with your question for Michael.
Hi, Cy and Michael. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Happy to.
So I visited a Greek Orthodox church, and the priest there, it was part of a seminary assignment, and the priest there made an interesting statement. He said that we did not leave the church in Rome. The church in Rome left us. And so I was curious how Michael might respond to that.
Yeah, because of course, from their perspective, they're going to say that we left them, right? And so here's the way to settle that question. Who maintains the faith of the ecumenical councils that we both as Catholics and Orthodox agree on? Who maintains the faith of those councils on the papacy? If we answer that question, I think that will tell us who broke away from whom. So if those councils taught the Catholic understanding of the papacy, and now the Eastern Orthodox reject that, I think it would be apparent that it is they, in that sense, at the very least, who broke away. And if it is, if the ecumenical councils taught their understanding of the papacy, that is the Eastern Orthodox understanding, one of them at least, and not what Catholics teach, then it would be us who broke away by coming up with innovative doctrine, doctrine that's not apostolic in nature. So that's ultimately what we have to consider. Now, what I do in the book repeatedly, whenever I engage the objections against the papacy, is I will take them to the primary sources that we agree on, the saints that we agree on, both as Catholics and Eastern Orthodox. And I especially take them to the councils that we agree on, the first seven ecumenical councils. And I point out interesting points from these councils where they're backing up things like papal infallibility or even papal supremacy, which are uniquely Catholic and are not currently embraced by the Eastern Orthodox. And I point out in their own tradition, here are these Catholic doctrines. So in other words, to be fully Eastern, you have to embrace the Catholic understanding of the papacy. And so if what I am arguing there is true, then the claim that we broke away from the Orthodox is not true. It would be that the Orthodox broke away from the very teachings that their own fathers embraced at these councils.
Hmm. Very good answer. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
He tends to do that, Byron. He does tend to do that. The number is 888-318-7884. We're talking with Michael Lofton about Orthodoxy and the Catholic Church. And we'll go to Ireland. Dominic is in Ireland watching on YouTube. Welcome, Dominic. Go ahead with your question.
Hello. How are you doing? Michael, first, I'd love to thank you. I used to be a rad. I mean, I would say mad rad. Okay. For probably the first year of when I became Catholic, and your videos were the main resource that changed my mind and made me see the error in my ways.
So glad to hear that.
Thank you very much for that.
What a gracious thing to say, Dominic.
Thank you. I have a few Orthodox friends. We had a conversation one night about what was it again? Adoration in relation to Catholicism and Orthodoxy. Yeah. And what their argument was is that there is no patristic traditions based around adoration, and that adoration is a post-schism occurrence. Therefore, it should be rejected. I tried looking through patristic sources as much as I could, and the most I could find was like pseudo documents of Chrysostom that were obviously written in the 1800s and the like. But do you know any patristic evidence of adoration, or that I could show them that adoration isn't like a heresy or something? Or
Yeah, this is actually one of the objections I address in the book. It's objection 25. And so you're certainly want to check out the book, but I'll summarize it here. Okay. Well, you can find things like Augustine talking about adoring the Eucharist. Now, the context seems to be whenever you go up to receive the Eucharist, adoring it, not necessarily taking the Eucharist outside of the liturgy and then venerating it. But the concept of adoring the Eucharist is certainly patristic. The occasion, the setting outside of the divine liturgy, okay, that is going to be something else. Now, I admit there is a little bit of a development here in the West with, again, adoring the Eucharist outside of the Divine Liturgy. I'm happy to say, even if there isn't any first millennium evidence of this particular devotion, that doesn't take away from the devotion itself, because you can certainly have devotions that arise in the first millennium, in the second century, third century, fourth century, or in the second millennium, in any century. There's nothing wrong with a devotion coming about, even if it wasn't there from day one. And in fact, I point out in Eastern Orthodoxy, the liturgical veneration of icons, the way the icons are venerated during the liturgy or even outside of the liturgy, is not necessarily something you're going to find in the first century. You're not going to find St. Paul adoring icons perhaps in the exact same way that we would have it by the end of the Seventh Ecumenical Council, Nicaea II. And yet Eastern Orthodox have this devotion of venerating icons, as do we Catholics, because we also embrace that council. And some might say, well, okay, but that's in the first millennium. But sure, but why is the first millennium in the eighth century somehow a standard? What if a Protestant comes along and says, you know what, you came up with this devotion of venerating icons, and you have this thing in the fifth, sixth, and seventh century, but I don't see it over there in the first century, so I think it's illegitimate. Well, I think it's arbitrary to start giving dates here. The question is the devotion wrong in and of itself, or is it good and holy? And when it comes to Eucharistic adoration, it's good and holy. And the principle of adoring the Eucharist, I think both Catholics and Orthodox can agree to. The question of doing so outside of the Divine Liturgy, I don't see anything objectively wrong with that. So even if you can't prove the devotion in the first millennium, I don't think that takes away from the holiness of it or the legitimacy of it any more than not being able to find liturgical veneration of icons in the second century takes away from Nicaea II's decision about venerating icons. Does that help answer the question a little bit?
Yeah, it does. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank sure. you, Dominic. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. Michael Lofton is our guest. His new book is Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. It's on sale right now at shop.catholic.com and probably anywhere else where you can get your Catholic books. Check it out, Answering Orthodoxy. If you have questions about the Orthodox and the relations between Orthodox and Catholic and how a Catholic makes sense of those, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884. Ricky's in Columbus, Ohio, watching on YouTube. Ricky, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Michael. Ricky?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, sorry, I'm at the gym. Sorry if you hear any music behind me. I just want to say thank you guys for all you do. I'm a revert to Catholicism 2 months ago. And I made the decision to revert solely on the decision to reject Protestantism, and I never really discerned Orthodoxy. And I recently discovered J. Dyer, which Michael, you might be familiar with. And he makes an argument for created grace and how Aquinas and Augustine developed this theology in the West, and how it's so different in the East, and things about St. Maximus. I know I threw a lot of stuff in there, but do you address these things in your book?
I do. It's actually the ninth objection where I address some of those things like created grace. I would also just point out that some of the Orthodox bishops in the United States would discourage anybody being catechized from some of the individuals that you mentioned there, which I'm very, very familiar with. So I would point that out. They don't necessarily represent Eastern Orthodoxy. Now, as far as created grace, I can deal specifically with that if that's what you wanted me to hone in on.
It's something I haven't studied a lot on, but I'd love to know more about it if you can.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of a misnomer. which is why I actually agree with Father Domic, who is an Eastern Orthodox priest who wrote a book objecting to some things in the Catholic tradition. But when it comes to the question of created grace, which I'll define here in a moment, he himself admits, look, this isn't an area where Catholics and Orthodox disagree at the doctrinal level. This isn't a point of contention. This is more an issue of terminology. I hear the music in the background. I can come on the other end of the break if you want me to finish it.
Yeah, yeah. Will you, if you're both, well, if everybody, every single person on earth will hang on, we will get Michael, the conclusion to Michael's answer on the other side. Hang on, Ricky, right back with more. Want to get right to the core of Christ's saving message? Want a roadmap for living the life Christ calls you to? It's time to look again at the Beatitudes. In his new book, Heart of the Gospel, How the Beatitudes Show Us God's Plan for Happiness, Father Sebastian Walsh demonstrates compellingly how these eight declarations make up the foundation, the essence, and the final goal of Jesus' teaching. Heart of the Gospel illuminates the scriptural passages from which we get the Beatitudes, explains the significance of their wording, their order, and their timing in Jesus' ministry. And it draws out edifying parallels and connections with salvation history and the lives of the saints. Most importantly, Father Walsh offers wise counsel from his own work as a priest and teacher to help you live the Beatitudes in your own life. Order your copy of Heart of the Gospel today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Our guest is Michael Lofton from Reason and Theology, which you should check out. It's easy to do. I tried it earlier today. You just type in Reason and Theology. You don't have to do anything fancy. Just type in Reason and Theology, and then your Google machine will get you there. He's got a new book out called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. It's got 30 objections from an Orthodox position to the Catholic faith, and then in very simple format, it just answers those questions. And sometimes you just get page and a half or something. Sometimes you get 5 or 6 pages, depending on what is merited for that particular objection. So if you are in any way interested in the relationship between Orthodoxy and Catholicism, Answering Orthodoxy, the book for you. And it's on sale right now at shop.catholic.com. Ricky's on the line in Columbus, Ohio, and wanted to know about created grace. And you were in the midst of answering, Michael.
Yeah, and it's important that we define our terms, especially on this one. What Orthodox are effectively going to say is that with the concept of created grace in Catholicism, we're basically saying that that which we receive from God, grace, is created. So we're never really coming into contact with the divine. We're never really receiving God. That's kind of the way that they will put the argument. Now, here's the problem. This is just merely an issue of terminology. When we speak of created grace, what we're saying is that there is a transformation in the creature when we go from being a child of darkness, if you will, as the Bible puts it, a child of wrath, as St. Paul specifically puts it, and we're then made a son of or daughter of God. We're made a child of God. In that moment where we transition and become a new covenant member in Christ Jesus. There's a new creation. And Paul, in fact, talks about that. We're a new creature in Christ because we've gone from being dead to our sins to now alive in Christ. There's a new creature. What we're saying is that new creature, that is a new created reality. That's what we're referring to when we speak of created grace. This new creature that we've become. We're not saying that that which we receive, which is God's grace, we're not saying the grace itself is created. Otherwise, we would actually be saying that God is created because it's God that we're receiving. So we're not saying that God is created when we speak of created grace. We're saying that that which we received, which is uncreated, which is divine, transforms us and creates in us a new reality. That's what we're referring to. So really, it's just simply a misunderstanding in terminology, which, again, I agree with Father Domic, an Eastern Orthodox priest and theologian, who says, well, perhaps we might want to just call it something else. And he even points out in their own tradition, in Orthodox tradition, they do sometimes speak of created grace. But he proposes that we just call it something else. And I don't have a problem with that because there is no official teaching of the church that says you have to call this reality created grace. That's not official magisterium of the church. It's more certain groups of theologians call it that.
Ricky, I hope that that was helpful to you. And I know that you said you are considering Orthodoxy. So I'd like to send you a copy of Michael's new book, Answering Orthodoxy. If you want to give us an address, just hang on the line. We will send it out because it's available now. So we can send it out to people. Answering Orthodoxy, a Catholic response to attacks from the East. But I got to keep going because I'm just realizing there are lots of folks on the line. Dan's in Fargo, North Dakota, listening on Real Presence Radio. Dan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Michael Loft.
Hi. I've been on your show before a long time ago, and you told me I should have my own podcast. But anyway.
Well, how's that going?
Well, I don't have any interest in it.
Oh.
In podcasts.
Well, I've made lots of useless suggestions to people over the years.
Okay, so when I came into the Catholic Church, I have to turn the radio down. I was confirmed by and taught by someone named Archbishop Jim Kelleher. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He may be passed away now. I don't know. It was years ago. He was an archbishop in Kansas.
Okay.
But anyway, he really stressed the Nicene Creed. Okay, that was, you know, those things had to be, you know, followed. Okay, but my question has to do with, he never stressed all the Mariology that goes on today, you know, and whenever someone asks for prayer, all they get is someone starts up with the rosary instead of a prayer for them. And I was just wondering, does the Orthodox Church have all that Mariology too?
Great question. So yeah, this is where I think we're going to find common ground with the Eastern Orthodox. They're very, very high in their Mariology. And you'll see that especially in devotional practices and in the Divine Liturgy explicitly. You'll see references to the Virgin Mary very prominently. And so I don't think that this is an area where Catholics and Orthodox are really going to be at odds. I think that you're going to find that there's, in fact, a lot of common ground here when it comes to the Virgin Mary. I get what you're saying, though, when some people might give you the impression that there's an overemphasis here on Mary. And I understand that we can't necessarily overemphasize Mary insofar as in any time that we honor the Virgin, we're also honoring Christ and what he did. But I get that sometimes you might hear people talk more about the Virgin Mary than they do Jesus. And that might be a little off-putting. I totally understand that. But I don't think it's coming from a bad place with Catholics. And I don't think it's coming to the exclusion of Jesus. I think that they're just pointing out that the Virgin Mary is a great intercessor. And so that's why she has a very central place when it comes to interceding for us and petitions that we might have. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, it does. I I learned about an Orthodox church from someone named Father Anderson out of, I believe, San Diego, California. He had a set of videotapes, and he never really talked about with their doctrine and everything. He never really talked about the Virgin Mary any more than anybody else would either. So that's why I was kind of wondering.
Well, it does sound like you have some troubles with the Mariology thing. I will be happy to send you a book we have called Behold Your Mother, which is about the Marian doctrines by our own Tim Staples. You just got to hang on and I'll send it to you. But I didn't want to interrupt if you were continuing the conversation, Michael. I just wanted to offer that book.
Oh, I think that's a great offer. And yeah, I guess I find that interesting that he doesn't really bring up the Virgin Mary. That's kind of curious. I mean, you're going to find things in the Divine Liturgy where we say, "O Holy Theotokos, save us." And so you're going to find very, very prominent aspects of the Virgin Mary in the Divine Liturgy. So I think once you're confronted with its devotional life and reality, you're going to see that there.
Thank you, Dan. Hang on. If you'd like a copy of that book, we'll send it to you. Rob's in Nebraska listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Rob, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Michael.
Yeah, so my wife's Orthodox, and after 30-some years, we've had any number of conversations on probably every topic in his book. But one that comes up quite a bit, and I've tried to do research on, is the difference between the two dates that we use to celebrate Easter. And so this year will be one of the extreme examples where it's like 5 or 6 weeks apart, and then some years it's the same. So if you could explain the debate on how Easter is calculated and maybe give me a reference, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, curiously, this was actually the first debate between Eastern and Western churches that we can find. In the second century, in fact, Pope Victor had a dispute with the churches of Asia Minor in the East, and in fact attempted to excommunicate them and cut them off from the common union, as Eusebius says, which here shows papal supremacy, because he's not cutting them off from Roman communion. He's cutting them off from the communion of the Catholic Church. And he got some pushback from figures like Irenaeus saying, maybe this is a little rash. May not want to cut them off on this issue. And that what they were disputing was the date of Easter. And what was pointed out to Pope Victor by Irenaeus and others was that, you know, in previous centuries, like with figures like Polycarp, not previous centuries, but previous decades, I should say, figures like Polycarp and others celebrated, they celebrated Easter at different times. And these two groups would say, well, they got their tradition from the apostles, but they're celebrating Easter at different times. And they're both claiming that this is apostolic, you know, when they celebrate it. And Polycarp and the Bishop of Rome at the time said, okay, let's agree to disagree on this issue. We both received our traditions on when to celebrate Easter from the apostles. So let's just agree to disagree on when it's going to be, and we're still going to celebrate the liturgy together. But Pope Victor comes along a little bit later and, you know, it's tries to make it a bigger deal than it in fact was. And you know, Rome eventually backed away from that, but you start to already see tremors between East and West on this very issue. And it kind of lasts until this day. The difference for Catholics and Orthodox on the dating of Easter has to do with which calendar do we use? Do we use the Julian calendar of a pagan emperor? Or do we use the calendar that a pope created in the second millennium, the Gregorian calendar? And that's going to then determine when Easter is. But in reality, what I like to point out is, well, when this dispute originally came up, and we see Polycarp in Rome noting that they have differences on, you know, how to calculate Easter, they said, let's agree to disagree on this issue. It's not going to be something that breaks communion between us. And I think that that's how we should perceive it today. If we can't agree on a common date of Easter, which, by the way, Pope Francis and the Patriarch of Bartholomew are currently working on it. But if we can't agree on that, let's not let that be an obstacle for breaking communion, because the earliest Christians, the disciples of the earliest apostles, said that this wasn't worth breaking communion over. And I think that's the attitude we should maintain.
Rob, that brings me right to when I got to go to the break, so I hope it was helpful to you. But if you'd like a copy of Michael's new book, Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East, I will be happy to send it to you. Just give your address in Nebraska to Edgar, and we'll send it off. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of this conversation about the Catholic faith, the Orthodox Church, and how we relate to one another. If you've got questions that fall into that vein, if you're an Orthodox person, you're welcome. If you're a Catholic person, you're welcome. If you're neither of the above, you are welcome. 888-318-7884.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Dive deeper into your faith as renowned speakers examine pressing issues facing Catholics today. EWTN takes you to Napa, California for a special two-day event.
Oh, God has His way. God has His providence.
The whole point of the Christian life is love. Love of God and the love of everybody.
The annual Napa Institute Conference, beginning Saturday at 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and His gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. You need to get on over to shop.catholic.com right now and get your copy of Michael Lofton's brand new book, Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. The promo code is Orthodoxy, and it saves you 25% off the already discounted sale price when you check out at shop.catholic.com. Check it out now, shop.catholic.com. Michael Lofton's new book, Answering Orthodoxy. Get an additional 25% off in addition to our fall savings that are going on right now when you use the promo code Orthodoxy when you check out. 25% extra off. The number here is 888-318-7884. If you've got questions about relations between the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, you're very, very welcome to call 888-318-7884. Caleb's in Illinois listening on 92.5 FM. Caleb, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Michael.
Thanks. I appreciate you having me on. I'm a Protestant, but my question is about theosis, which, as I understand, is a pretty prominent Eastern Orthodox doctrine. But it's one that I don't know what Catholics think about. So, and I may not have a proper understanding of theosis either. The closest thing I can relate it to is sanctification in the Protestant history. But will you help me understand both what it is as well as what Catholics think about it compared to Eastern Orthodox?
Yeah, and you said you're coming from a Protestant background. Which one, if you don't mind me asking specifically?
Yeah, so I was raised evangelical, but I'm now in a Mennonite denomination.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, when y'all speak of the order of salvation, I imagine y'all refer to the concept of glorification, right?
Yes.
Okay. So that's kind of what this concept refers to. You do rightly point out it also includes sanctification, but glorification is also in view here. And what these terms mean for those who are not familiar, sanctification refers to growing in holiness, living a holier life. Glorification refers to that final state of what we're going to be when God is done working in us. You know, it's ultimately going to be fulfilled in the next life. Now, what this refers to, theosis specifically, you'll see both Catholics and Orthodox affirming this because it's a biblical concept. So to answer your question, Catholics wholeheartedly agree with theosis because it's found in the New Testament. You can see St. Peter referring to us becoming partakers of the divine nature. to use his terminology in the New Testament. That is the basis of theosis, that we become partakers of the divine nature. It doesn't mean that we somehow become eternal, right? Because we're clearly never going to be. I mean, there was always a point in time in which you could say we were not. So we're not eternal beings. So we're not going to be God as God. But we can certainly become like him. Insofar as he gives us his divine life and transforms us and makes us a new creature in Christ. That's what theosis is referring to. And that's what Peter is referring to whenever he speaks of us becoming partakers of the divine nature. So yeah, we as Catholics, we're right there on board with Eastern Orthodox on the question of theosis, as any Christian should be.
Caleb? Did we lose Caleb? All right. Well, Caleb, I appreciate the call. Thank you very, very much. That's what happens when you use one of those Mennonite phones. You get these long pauses. No? Okay. I guess that wasn't funny. Sorry. Caleb, I was going to say if Caleb would hold on, we'll give him a copy of the book, but Caleb got mad about my Mennonite joke. I apologize, Caleb. Cecil's in Marietta, California, listening to EW10 on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Cecil, we're awful glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Michael Lofton.
Yes, I used to be a Protestant, and then I came to the Catholic Church through the Episcopal, and then I became Orthodox, Antiochian, and then I'm Catholic. I came home to the Catholic Church. And of course, the Orthodox love Our Lady, so there's no question there. And but what I was asking, what I wanted to ask was, I talked to an Orthodox monk, and he basically was saying that that the rosary wasn't a good prayer because, you know, you're praying, you're focusing on Mary, and then you have a petition, and then, you know, and how do you, or even you're talking about the different mysteries, but you're saying Mary, you know, you're talking about Our Lady, and so, I, in other words, for example, the joyful mysteries, obviously, it's much more conducive, I guess. I mean, it's not like you're bifurcating in your mind so much, but if you're looking, let's say, at the sorrowful mysteries, then, but you're saying Hail Mary, you know, and then plus you've got you have a prayer intention that they've got all this going on. And I guess as a monk, I don't know if this is necessarily just Orthodox in general, but just as he, as a monk, just found that as not cognitive dissonance, you know, that wasn't really an appropriate thing. I don't know, you know, so I just wanted to get your take on if that's one of the issues that an Orthodox person may have with the rosary.
You know, it's interesting that the Russian Orthodox Saint Seraphim of Sarov, who, by the way, I think it was, I think it's Pope Francis has a picture of him. And I believe it was John Paul II who called him saint, if I recall correctly. Well, anyways, this Eastern Orthodox saint, highly venerated in Orthodoxy, often prayed a version of the rosary. So I'll point that out. Number two, I don't know anybody who would dispute that Metropolitan Callistus Ware, the late Metropolitan Callistus Ware, is probably the most important figure in the last 100 years in Eastern Orthodoxy. Incredible bishop and theologian and scholar. When I interviewed him on my channel, I asked him about the rosary and asked him his thoughts about it. He had no problem with it. He thought it was a beautiful devotion. So you'll find plenty of Eastern Orthodox that don't have an issue with the rosary. As to those who say, well, you're focusing too much on Mary, I understand why somebody would say that, especially if they come from a Protestant background. But I think it's misguided because one is not focusing on Mary for the sake of Mary. Rather, one is honoring the Virgin Mary because of what Christ has done. And it is also, we are asking her for intercession so that we can be united more to God. And so the ultimate end here isn't somehow a union with Mary, it's a union with God. So I don't see anything wrong with the rosary, and I don't see anything in it that Eastern Orthodox would ultimately have to object to, which is why many Orthodox don't object to the rosary.
Got it. I appreciate that. Yeah, he happened to be a Russian Orthodox monk. So what was the name of that individual that I could cite?
Yes, Saint Seraphim of Sarov.
Of course.
S A R O V.
Thanks so much.
Cecil, sure. If you want to hold on, I'll send you a copy of Michael's new book, Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. It's out now from Catholic Answers Press, and we'd love you to have a copy. Thank you very much for the call. Michael, as I go through the 30, I have to say one of them stood out to me. And when I say go through the 30, there are 30 kind of Eastern Orthodox objections to the Catholic faith. And many of them are quite profound, and they elicit from you profound meditations and responses. But one of them is Catholics celebrate clown masses. What does that mean, and why is it in this book?
Yeah, I know that probably takes people by surprise, right?
Well, it sticks out, I can tell you that.
This is probably the weakest objection that one could offer, and yet it tends to be the most persuasive for people.
Really? Oh, how interesting.
Because I think it appeals to people's emotions. I remember there was a debate between a Catholic and an Eastern Orthodox on my channel, and whenever the Orthodox individual was losing the debate, he just made a beeline straight for this objection, and I thought it was pretty interesting. what this objection says effectively is that, you know, Catholics have these liturgical abuses, and so clearly it's not the church established by Christ. And I just think, look, this is a really bad argument. Because an abuse is just that, it's an abuse. So you can't say, well, because you have an abuse, that somehow means you're a church that Christ didn't establish. Look, in the Old Testament, they had plenty of liturgical abuses. That doesn't mean that the covenantal sacrificial system that God created was somehow illegitimate. It was, you know, it was in fact legitimate, but there were people who abused it. No doubt. Likewise, Eastern Orthodox, unfortunately, in some cases have some concerning liturgical abuses in some cases. And so this is an issue that we all have. So we want to be consistent here. We don't want to be hypocritical. I would never say that, well, if there's a liturgical abuse in Eastern Orthodoxy, that somehow invalidates any of their claims to being an apostolic church. I would never make that argument, and I don't think it's fair when Orthodox do with that with Catholics. Yeah. I'll also point out, I've never seen a clown mass. These are incredibly rare. That being said, you might find other forms of liturgical abuse in Catholicism, but it's just that. It's an abuse. It's not something that should be taking place.
Well, it does seem to be picking on us for a fact about us, which is not a permanent fact. I mean, we are in a liturgical crisis in the Latin side of the church. And I don't even mean in all the churches that are part of the Catholic Church. I mean, particularly the Latin Rite. We've been in a liturgical crisis for 60, 70 years. And, you know, in the life of the church, that's a moment, but that would seem an odd thing to condemn us for. It seems more just maybe pray for us while we're going through it, but it's not a permanent feature of the Latin Rite.
No, it's not a good argument, but I will point out, it does persuade a lot of people who are emotionally fed up with the liturgical abuse. And this kind of argument seems to promise them, hey, come to Orthodoxy where you won't experience these liturgical abuses.
Oh, yeah. But
you know what? The grass isn't always necessarily greener on the other side.
No. And as you have pointed out before, we have Eastern Rite churches in, you know, who's like our the liturgy, even if you use the old liturgy in the Latin Rite, it's a few hundred years old. But if you go to the Maronite Rite or Melkite Rite, you're going to get truly ancient liturgies.
Oh, yeah. Everything that you can find liturgically in Eastern Orthodoxy, you have in Eastern Catholicism.
Michael Lofton, again, congratulations on the book. The book is called Answering Orthodoxy, A Catholic Response to Attacks from the East. Excuse me. It's available now at shop.catholic.com. Get an extra 25% off in addition to the savings that are going on there because of our fall sale. Just use the promo code Orthodoxy when you check out and you get that extra 25% off. Thank you, Michael. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Michael Lofton, you can check him out over at Reason and Theology. Just type in Reason and Theology into your machine, and you'll find your way there. Again, the book is Answering Orthodoxy. That does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.